content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. And our first reading today is called Bird by Bird by Jenny Rothenberg Gritz, not sure how to pronounce that. And the subtitle is Avian America. It's a radiant morning, and the zoo is filled with birds. Robins bathe in a waterfall. Pigeons peck at a disordered slice of pizza. Mallards circle around the artificial pond. Near a fence, strollers pause as chubby fingers point at the flamingos. These creatures from the Caribbean are sleeping, balanced on one leg, no less. Long necks twisted backward. Bills nestled in the cotton candy feathers. Everybody loves the colorful ones, says Sarah Halliger, bird curator at the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute. I happen to like ones. And along the path hops a tiny wood thrush, the official bird of Washington, D.C. See, a brown bird, but he's got that spotted breast and that beautiful song. This past March, the zoo reopened its birdhouse after a six-year renovation. Visitors can now wander through three indoor habitats. The first is filled with Delaware Bay shorebirds. The second is modeled after a prairie where ducks refuel during migration. The third resembles a Latin American coffee farm. Orange and black Baltimore Oreos are at home in that tropical habitat. People in these parts might think it's my Baltimore Oreo, Halliger notes, but in the winter, it lives in Central America, and it's someone else's Oreo. This is one reason people love birds. A baseball team in Maryland can be named for a species that winters in Nicaragua. Birds have never cared about the boundaries between North and South Korea or East and West Berlin. Some of the farthest flyers migrate from Canada to Chile, Alaska to New Zealand. The birdhouse at the National Zoo is home to scarlet tanagers, T-A-N-A-G-E-R-S, indigo buntings, and American yellow warblers. But Halliger makes sure to point out the brown Cory bustards in the outdoor arena. Visitors are missing out if they don't stop and admire these ostrich-like birds from the African savanna with herringbone tweed necks and dotted underbellies. Their heads are especially endearing, a sloping mullet of feathers, and a brow that gives them a perpetually studious expression. That's my girl, Halliger says proudly, pointing to one of the Cary bustards. She was born here. I hand-raised her. As soon as I walk by, she'll come over. For Halliger, who has been working with birds at the zoo since 1989, these feathered friends are like pets. The smaller birds, like the ones in the coffee farm exhibit, live 5 to 8 years. But the larger birds outside can live to be 25 or 30. Parrots can reach their 80s or 90s. At the edge of the outdoor pens, bird behaviorist Feng Liu introduces visitors to creatures they've never been able to approach in the wild. Vultures, ravens, macaws, cockatoos. He disappears briefly into a small tent and then emerges holding a nest full of white-throated magpie jays. They're just a few weeks old, still very much babies, he says, as the chicks squawk and climb on each other's back. Lou and Halliger call these babies ambassador birds, hoping they'll inspire visitors to protect wildlife. That might mean drinking shade-grown coffee, which prevents the clear-cutting of forests, or it might mean keeping cats indoors. People say, "My Fluffy doesn't kill birds," Halliger says. "Yes, he absolutely does." The final birds Lou brings out in the tent are white-faced owlets. No photograph or children's book is adequate preparation for the feeling of holding one. The dark-edged feathers and prickle of little feet. Most astonishing is the feeling of staring into those perfectly round eyes, deep blue pupils surrounded by saucers of bright orange. It's oddly similar to the way a newborn human baby looks out at the world. A quiet, steady gaze loaded with mystery and intelligence. Once people have that connection, they listen a bit more and they care a little bit more, Lou says. The talented wildlife photographers featured on these pages will attest to that. We asked them to send us exclusive images of their favorite birds taken near their own homes, pausing to look closely at a bird to enjoy its song is one of the easiest and most powerful ways to commune with nature. Birds are beautiful and varied, musical and free, and they're everywhere. And there's a full page picture here of I relate these birds because they can be so still, patient, and quiet as they hunt by themselves, Jess Moore says. I try to emulate them, their stillness, in order to photograph them. And that is what I just read is by Steve Jess Moore, and this is a full page of a bird that they don't identify. And it got a little map of the U.S. and shows the range of this bird, which is about two-thirds of the country, mostly in the eastern part of the country. And as we continue, Lords of the Dance by Nopal Peothong, Colombian sharp-tailed grouse. If it looks like these two sharp-tailed grouses are taking part in an elaborate dance, they are. As females look on, the males point their tails upward, spread their wings, hold their heads low, and stamp their feet in a stuttering pattern. These courtship demonstrations are so elaborately choreographed and perfectly synchronized that Native American groups have emulated them. To this day, the northern Tuchon, T-U-T-C-H-O-N-E, First Nations group of Yukon continues to perform a grouse dance. The Colombian sharp-tailed grouse can be found in the north central and western U.S. and parts of Canada. To get this image, Peothong showed up on a frigidly cold Wyoming morning before the birds arrived. Around 5 a.m., he set up a photo blind or camouflage tent away from the mating ground and waited expectantly for the dance to begin. Working inside a photo blind provides very limited vision and mobility, he says. The biggest challenge was to keep his fingers warm enough to work the equipment when this magic moment finally arrived. And here's one of them on the, looks like snow on the ground. A male Colombian sharp-tailed grouse bow to a dance-off. The purple air sac that inflates during this ritual is an extension of the esophagus. Next page, Surprise Visitors by Melissa Grew. evening grosbeak, photographed in Ithaca, New York. The evening grosbeak tends to hover north of Gru's home in central New York State. She was so delighted when a flock of them recently appeared outside her house. When they roam further south in winter in search of food, I've been blessed with their presence, sometimes over months, she says. This past winter and into very early spring, I had a flock of up to 15 visiting my platform, bird feeder, daily, hovering up black oil sunflower seeds. Seeds and berries are favorite food sources for these birds. In the summer, they also eat insects. While they breed in coniferous forests, their southern migrations don't always take them to the same place, which makes their appearances somewhat unpredictable. Gru made the most of the grosbeak's visit to get this shot. She waited at her open upstairs window for 2 hours, training her lens on a sugar maple tree where the birds liked to perch. It was very cold despite my layers of clothing, she says. But when I have my lens trained on birds like this, discomfort takes a back seat, and I can endure all kinds of things. Next bird, Big Birds on the Block by Jack Wonderly, the great egret. Wonderly was walking in downtown Santa Rosa when he saw a stark white bird with a 5-foot wingspan flying overhead, carrying a stick. Another appeared, then another. Following the birds and the sound of bird calls, I came to 2 large eucalyptus trees that are a rookery for egrets and herons, Wonderly says. Construction in the late 1990s apparently disturbed their earlier breeding colony, so the birds established a new one, right in the middle of a boulevard. In the late 1800s, great egrets, were hunted nearly to extinction because their plumes were prized for ladies' hats. The National Audubon Society helped save them, using the great egret as its logo. They're incredibly graceful, spectacular birds, Wonderly says. The chicks, however, emerge with green skin and spiky white feathers. They look like Muppets. To save chicks that plop in the street in Santa Rosa, volunteers place straw to cushion their falls and scoop them up so they can be raised to adulthood. International Bird Rescue has successfully released more than 100 egrets and herons in a given year, he says, all from this one area. Juvenile great egrets with scuffy heads engage in feeding behavior. As adults, they'll stand over 3 feet tall and have a cruising speed around 25 miles per hour. There's a picture of 2 of them playing or fighting, I'm not sure which. And here's a roadrunner, and a roadrunner can run as fast as 25 miles per hour. But unlike its Looney Tunes version, it can't quite outrun a coyote, which covers 35 to 43 miles per hour. Courtship Rituals by Corrine Agner. When a male roadrunner courts a female, he may bring a gift, a dead lizard, a centipede, a dragonfly, or a small bird. After holding out his offerings, he proceeds to mate with a female. It's an effective seduction tactic. Roadrunners mate for life. The bird in this picture is a regular visitor to the South Texas ranch where Agner teaches photography workshops. He's known around the ranch as Sir Walter Camillo Meeplethorpe. That's a mouthful. For a while last year, he seemed forlorn. Each day that summer, Sir Walter would hoo call, she says, a sound not unlike the cooing of a dove. Sir Walter kept showing up at a half-built nest and calling out, a gift always in his mouth. Bird biologists suggested to Agner that Sir Walter had lost his mate, and the unfinished nest seemed like an ominous sign. Toward the end of summer, Agner spotted a female roadrunner she'd never seen before. And then I saw Sir Walter, she says. He ran toward the patio and stopped in front of me. The female seemed skittish at first. Then one day I walked out the door and they were mating, says Agner. And I was nothing less than ecstatic. Up next, Beach Bodies by Mikhail Milicia. Piping Plover. Walking along a beach, and I wish I was better at describing these birds. Many are cute, and most of them are very beautiful. Well, all of them are beautiful. Photograph location, Ipswich, Massachusetts. Walking along a beach in the eastern United States, you might spot one of these small round birds in the midst of its signature foot-trembling maneuver. Piping plovers will dash along the shore and then suddenly stop and tap the sand with one foot. The leading theory holds that the goal of all this stomping is to startle insects and other prey, making them easier to detect and catch. The piping plover is an endangered species, almost gone from the Great Lakes region where it once thrived. If you're lucky enough to spot one on the Atlantic coast, you'll have a good shot at getting a picture, since these birds frequently visit beaches and tend to be well acclimated to humans. But to get a spectacular shot like this one, says Milicia, it helps to be lying down. I approach the birds on foot until I am about twice the distance that I want to be, and still far short of their fear circle, he says. I then lie down and slowly belly crawl to get closer. Most of the time, the birds are unbothered by this approach, but if they are reacting to my presence, I move on. An Owl on the Prowl by Garrett Vyn, V-Y-N, Northern Pygmy Owl. Portland, Oregon. In western Oregon, where Vyn lives, the tooting of the northern pygmy owl is the sound of spring. Even when you don't see them, while hiking through the forest or sitting in a lush patch of sword ferns on the forest floor and looking up into the canopy, just knowing they are somewhere up there watching deepens the experience and magic of the place, he says. Vyn spent 10 days waiting near the nest cavity in this tree, hoping for owlets to emerge, watching the mother owl and her mate deliver food to the chicks. He saw an astonishing range of prey species. In the pre-dawn hours, moths were commonly delivered, and as the day progressed, there was a steady stream of small mammals and birds. Mice and voles were often on the menu, as were birds ranging from the tiny Wilson's warbler to the much larger black-headed grosbeak. Although these owls aren't much bigger than house sparrows, they can prey on species up to 3 times their size. Vyn's advice to aspiring bird photographers is to study their habits and schedules. Become a better naturalist. Birds know better. Pretty in Pink by Max Stone, Everglades of National Park, Florida. When Stone was a biologist with the National Audubon Society, he used to love watching a spoonbill chick push out its shell. And it used the only tool it had, a blunt pink spoon, he says. The distinctive bill would prove to be useful as the chick grew up to scoop up crustaceans and fish. Naturalists have fun describing these birds. The spoonbill exhibits paradoxical glamour and drollery, wrote Robert Potter Allen in 1942. I have a twisted tongue this morning. The Audubon Society's website describes it in the words of contemporary field guide author Ken Kaufman. Gorgeous at a distance and bizarre up close, after being almost exterminated by plume hunters in the late 1800s, roseate spoonbills have made a remarkable, though incomplete, comeback. They're usually found along the Gulf Coast and farther south, but with sea level rise impacting their fishing grounds, they've been sighted farther north in Virginia, Maryland, the District of Columbia, New York, and even as far as Michigan and Connecticut. The distinctive pink of the roseate spoonbill's plumage comes from pigments called carotenoids, absorbed from the aquatic invertebrates it eats. Giant from the Ice Age by Joshua Azzell. California condor. The location is Pinnacles National Park, California. For anyone who considers the California condor an unsightly bird, Azzell suggests watching them at sunset. Their heads and crops can reflect the entire range from yellow to pink to crimson, he says. You can hear the wind flow past the massive wingtips, almost like the sound of dozens of swords simultaneously swinging through the air. California condors are the largest bird species in North America. They are critically endangered, with just 275 free-flying in California, Utah, Arizona, and Baja California. They serve the environment by cleaning up animal carcasses, a role that they've played since the days of woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers. If you're lucky enough to have one of these flying giants soar right past you and look you right in the eye, you can immediately sense their undeniable intelligence, says Azzell, who has spent the better part of a decade working for their conservation. And I don't mean they look at you in some general way. They look directly into your eyes. Wouldn't that be an experience? And that wraps up the article on the birds. We're almost finished, however. And when we get to a place like this, I'd like to look at the front. Discussion at the front of the magazine. Butler's quilts are next step in the evolution of the quilt as art. It is supremely ironic that Will McCarthy's article, The Frontier Midwife, in the July-August edition, bemoaning the lack of recognition accorded Anna Pierce for her research on milk sickness, almost skips past the Native American woman who flat out told her, "It's caused by that plant over there." Seems like the unnamed Native American woman deserves at least as much recognition. That's from Bill McLeod of Whitehall, Michigan. Treasures of Fiber Art. And these are comments from readers of earlier editions of Smithsonian. Bisa Butler's gorgeous quilts, Dreaming in Color, in the July-August 23 edition of Smithsonian, and the symbolism within them are the next step in the evolution of the quilt as art, which it always has been, even though the art world denied that for centuries, says Carrie Corthell of Dayton, Ohio. Having grown up surrounded by quilts, there was always a story behind the piece. Bisa Butler's work combines the art of a storyteller, the art of a photographer, the art of those creating fabrics, and her eye for all these into breathtaking works of art. There is love and story in every stitch, says C.J. Vadek of Las Vegas. Inside Los Alamos, thank you for the Moment of Truth, July article, and for the pictures included with it. I always have been interested in World War II and especially the development of the atom bomb, atomic bomb, perhaps because I grew up during the duck and cover era. I can't begin to imagine the soul-searching those who were involved must have gone through. Hopefully, your article will give others a glimpse of what that must have been like, says Susan Chipman from Suffield, Connecticut. Finding Willa Cather. Kudos to Jeff McGregor for a beautifully written tribute to Willa Cather, to Calla Kessler, and for the stunning photos that illuminate the world she lives in, to Smithsonian for recognizing the value of this often overlooked author, to her understanding of the people and the forces that created the American Midwest. It was a delight to read and a joy to learn that much of the culture they created still lives on in places like Red Cloud. Catherine Rudolph of Lompoc, California, wrote that in. Jeff McGregor found Willa Cather haunting Red Cloud like a magical mist. I hope his charming article will inspire many to read or reread Cather's great novels and to visit the town and the landscape she so lovingly portrayed. Malcolm O. Hagen of Chicago. And let's see if we can get in one more quick one. The African Atlantis, a new exhibition, imagines a world in which the Middle Passage creates lives instead of claiming them. When I was building the National Museum of African History and Culture, I was determined. Well, and we're going to have to end there, leave you hanging a little bit. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming was underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family, and we thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.